It's the Onion Radio News. God refloods the Middle East. This is Doyle Redland reporting. In what theological and meteorological authorities are calling a wrathful display of Old Testament proportions, the Lord Almighty reflooded the Middle East today. The Creator of all things made the decision to go ahead with His second great flood after last-ditch U.S.-Saudi peace initiatives were rejected at the 11th hour. Harley Minogue is a non-denominational spokesman for the all-powerful being.
God only promised humanity that He would never again flood the entire earth. He never said He wouldn't flood specific areas.
Though regretful about the severity of God's punishment, Mideast peace negotiators nonetheless praised Him for coming up with the first ever viable solution to the ongoing crisis. Doyle Redland for the Onion Radio News.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. And you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Hot, Wet, and Uncertain. What do scientists predict the Earth will be like in a few decades? Computer models suggest deterioration of agricultural land, crumbling bridges, flooded roads, and population shifts away from low-lying cities such as Miami and Amsterdam. How fast will the Arctic ice melt? What does this mean for the rest of the world? What are governments and businesses doing in the Bay Area and elsewhere to prepare for new water patterns that paradoxically may bring too much water at times in some areas and drought in others? And then after that, David Suzuki discusses the human environmental crisis and how it could be turned around in a generation.
Will Travis, California is considering an $11 billion water bond to fix the water system. Is that going to address the concerns, the changes in precipitation that we've been talking about?
I work for the state of California. We do not take position on Bond Act.
However, do you think that the Bond Act addresses the conveyance and capture issues? That will it address the need to have address some of the flooding that Wies Law is saying will happen? And
well, let me skirt around that by saying one of the things that Andy said is we don't have to worry about turning our taps and not having water, but one of the things we do have to be concerned about is we'll turn the tap and get salt water. Because in addition to the change of when you're having more of the precipitation falling as rain and less as snow, that means you're going to have much more runoff in the winter but less in the spring and summer. Without that pulse of fresh water coming out through the bay, the salt water will get much farther inland. And it gets into the delta, which is where those pumps are that draw the drinking water that's used by 23 million Californians. So the challenge for the water engineers in California is that we've got a system that's designed, as Andy explained it, and it's going to change because we're going to have to use those reservoirs that we have used for storage for flood control. So you'd use them for flood control all winter long. It rains, the water comes down, you hold it in the reservoir, you quickly drain it out, and you wait for the next storm. And you do that all winter long, and then you just stop at the last storm, and you collect all that water, and then you use it. Now, the challenge is to get the scientists to tell us when the next storm is. Because if we think it was the last storm and we fill the reservoirs, it means if we have another storm, we're going to have flooding. If we think there's one more storm coming, we'll empty the reservoir and wait for it. And if it doesn't come, we won't have any water. So that's the challenge we're going to be facing in re-engineering the whole system. Clearly, there's going to be a lot of money is going to be needed for making various improvements in the levees in the delta, more storage, both underground and appropriately designed above ground, conveyance systems. The Bond Act will provide money for some of that. Whether it is appropriately directed to the right projects, I will say that I am an employee of the state of California. We do not take position on Bond Acts.
You say that like you've said that before. Wies Law Maslowski, how long before climate models will give that kind of geographic certainty that people in policy need to tell whether there's another storm or not?
Well, I've been basically surviving all my life on competing for external grants and funds, and I'm very happy to report basically that many U.S. Funding agencies are now focusing and dedicating special resources to improve regional climate prediction, or basically improving the physical process representation in global models that can better address the questions that local governments and local communities need to have addressed. Basically, the approach is such that you can do something like telescoping zooming from a global model, which has this relatively low resolution, to improve a local picture and detail of what might be happening within a particular region, such as the Bay Area here. And there's also ongoing activities within the scientific community and modeling, basically developing regional climate models. So you use global climate models to somehow force a regional climate model. And the regional climate model has, first of all, much higher resolution, much shorter time scale, and is focused on a particular region that is of interest to a particular application. So, like in my case, we have DOE, Department of Energy, support for the fourth year now to develop a regional Arctic climate model. And if we have multiple models developed in such a way that they will improve the global model representation of particular regions, then they can feed back to global models and improve the global model predictions for the near future, as well as, you know, interannual to decadal predictability.
We've been talking about the different time frames here. I mean, you work in a profession where you look at decades and centuries. Right. Policymakers need things much shorter time frame. How soon do you think those models will be available?
Well, so we're talking about whether this is a climate model activity or weather forecasting. And I guess for the many applications locally, you need to have improved weather forecasting, but not only about the air temperature and precipitation, but maybe much more involving the system, involving the land picture and the ocean circulation. If you go up to the north sea ice as well, and you want to know whether this sea ice will disappear by 30% in the next month or within the next week. So the idea is that there are different timescales and different applications that need to have used them. And I'm talking about most of the time climate applications where the weather service is possibly a completely different area of expertise. And I believe that weather service, National Weather Service, they have much more and better resources to address those issues at a very short timescales on the local scale as well.
Wieslaw Maslowski is a research professor at the Naval Postgraduate School. We're discussing climate issues at the Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. Our other guests are Andy Gunther, Executive Director for the Center for Ecosystem Management and Restoration, and Will Travis, Executive Director of the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. Andy Gunther, you want to get on that?
Yeah, I think that to the extent that local governments or regional governments are waiting until we can get predictions in the 2 to 4 year time frame, that they don't understand what the problem is. What we can say for sure now is that we know something about the characteristics of the Bay Area 30 years from now, 40 years from now, 50 years from now. The distribution of temperatures right now on our planet as compared to the 1970s have changed, and this current pattern was predicted by scientists using their much less well-informed models than we have now in the 1970s. So the public policy question before us is whether we think it's worth to invest now to influence the nature of the Bay Area and other parts of our country and other parts of the world 30, 40, 50 years from now. We don't have the opportunity, we don't have the luxury of waiting and then making the decision. If we wait until 2030, we're not going to influence what the state looks like in 2050. Maybe we will influence what the state looks like in 2080. But that's what the basic physics of our modeling is telling us. And whether or exactly how high we might want to build a levee around SFO, I'm not sure. But I'm very comfortable right now saying we're going to have to build a levee around SFO.
Will Travis, which organizations or jurisdictions around the Bay are most advanced in recognizing the inevitability that, Andy just laid out?
Well, San Francisco, of course, is doing a great deal of work. Oakland, there are a number of jurisdictions around the Bay, but as I said, we've got 55 local jurisdictions, and if we have 54 of them deal with the problem and one doesn't, we have a problem in the region. I think that as we talk about the predictions and the models, it's really important, as Andy stressed. You can talk about what's happening with the Arctic sea ice and the melt, and you glaze over very quickly and say, well, that must be tough if you're a polar bear. I got to get back to doing the grocery list. And what we need to understand, I believe, as a society is, to some degree, the predictions, as Andy said, we can't wait for them to be perfect. They'll never be perfect. And it doesn't matter. If we park all of our cars, turn off all the lights, mothball all the power plants everywhere on the face of the earth right now, it's going to continue to get warmer for the next half century or more, and sea levels are going to continue to rise. How much, exactly how high, when it will get there, really doesn't matter. That's why it's important we start thinking and preparing for the inevitable now. Some people look at this and say, well, if that's the case, why even try to reduce greenhouse gases? Well, it's, as my doctor tells me, I hate to give you the bad news, but you're going to die. The idea is to postpone it as long as you can. So we do have a responsibility to try to make the problem that we are leaving as a legacy for our children and our grandchildren as small a problem as we possibly can. But we do have to start preparing for the inevitable right now.
And there are a couple of options. I mean, there's retreat, defend, and I guess there's a third one that I've forgotten in terms of the changing relationship between our built environment and the waterfront. So what are those choices?
Well, we view it for the region as essentially the same as a triage in a hospital room. We are going to have to decide which areas, what are the resources that we're going to protect as long as we can. New Orleans has been called the impossible city at the inevitable location. I think you could apply the same thing to San Francisco. We're going to do everything we can to keep the financial district from going underwater. We're going to do the same for Silicon Valley, the international airports, other areas. There are some areas where we can take advantage of the enormous investment we've made in wetland restoration. I think it's important to realize that the Bay Area is the most urbanized estuary in the United States of America. It also has the second largest wetland restoration project outside of the Everglades. So we are doing both.
That's the salt marshes?
That's the salt marshes in the North and South Bay. So we are investing a lot in restoring wetlands. And tidal wetlands are just wonderful for dealing with climate change. All wetlands are great for flood control. They soak up flood water and they absorb wave energy. So the wider the wetland in the front, the lower the levee can be in the back. Tidal wetlands actually do something else. They take carbon out of the atmosphere and they put it into the ground. They sequester carbon. So tidal wetland restoration projects can be part of both a strategy for reducing greenhouse gases and a strategy for adapting to those impacts that you can't reduce or eliminate. So we're going to have to look at where we're going to do lots of wetland restoration and provide place for those wetlands to migrate. And then the third part of the triage is where are those special areas that can go either way or need special attention. There, what we're doing at BCDC, the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, is we partnered with the Dutch and looking at some of the techniques that they've used for cities that float, structures that you can move, relocate over time. In Germany, in Hamburg, they have occasional flooding, so they just design downtown so it will flood. And I call them, it's kind of the West Coast equivalent of snow days. I'm sorry, you can't go to the ferry building today. It's closed. It's flooded. But come back tomorrow. So there are different ways that I think we can build along the shoreline and can adapt to the inevitable sea level rise.
Andy?
Yeah, and I think what Will is noting about come back tomorrow, I think it's a really important point to note that the sea level rise itself is a very gradual process. And when people hear that sea level rise was going up at 3 millimeters a year on average, right, they think, I mean, what's the problem? I guess maybe in 10 years I'll have to put galoshes on if I want to keep my feet dry. But the flooding is an episodic event that is driven by several different things, one of which, say, for coastal flooding around the Bay Area, is the sea level. It's also the tide. And then the weather. When you get a low-pressure system and there's less, in essence, pressure on the water, the ocean actually comes up. And so things become magnified. So the people who are really doing a lot of thinking about this is the insurance industry. And anybody who – there's some very accessible stuff produced by Lloyd's of London or whatever, but you can look and see that just a foot rise in sea level takes a 1-in-100-year flood and turns it into a 1-in-10-year flood. So imagine the disaster of some storm with sea level and everything flooding and damaging the runway, Oakland Airport. And we get it together to clean it up and repair it and then it happens again in 10 years.
They already have a little of that going on now.
And remember, we tend to think about, people talk about, well, how high will the sea level be in 2100? But one of the other things we know is that wherever it is, it's going to be going up faster than it is now. And so I think it's really an important thing to realize that the damages come from these episodic events where even though sea level itself is a gradual increase over time.
Mm-hmm. It raises a question about science and public communication, because a lot of what comes out of scientific bodies, the IPCC and others, is focuses on sea level rise. And a lot of that, people can look at that and say, hey, it's too slow or I'll be dead by then, or it's too gradual to really, it's Al Gore's, you know, frog in a gradually boiling pot of boiling water. So Wieslaw Maslowski, let's talk about the communication of science to the general public, whether scientists ought to do a better job or it's not their job to do that.
Well, scientists definitely ought to do a better job. However, the point is that as a scientific community, we don't have in our contract signed anything related to public relation and outreach. This is at our or your free time, and as depends how much time you commit to communicating and how well communicating, that's the message that comes out in the end in the news media and the internet. The point about scientists is that we can talk about uncertainties, but we are much more difficult position to give you numbers. Mm-hmm. So as Will and discussion went on before, whether it's going to be 3 millimeter per year or 5 millimeter per year or something else, we can talk about uncertainty on those estimates, but not a given number. In the Arctic, for example, there is this discussion how soon the old ice, sea ice, will disappear during summer. So we'll open the routes for navigation, natural resource exploration, tourism, and what have you. And the thing is that we know that it could happen as soon as within next decade, or it can happen until maybe 2100. So there is a range, and there is maybe some higher probability in the middle somewhere, but the range is such that it could be something like 2020 or maybe something like 2080. We should be prepared as soon as 2020, but also think about how we proceed if it's going to be all the way out until 2080.
We have a political system that doesn't handle that kind of uncertainty well, or that time frame. We have a political system that deals on very short attention spans, short media cycles, short election cycles. So does the political system need to change, or the scientific establishment in the way it communicates uncertainty?
Well, I think we need more citizen science and citizen scientists to be basically growing up within this country and elsewhere throughout the world. So those people understand well the science, and they are well qualified by their education and expertise to communicate to the public. And I think that we, as a scientific community, we're being pushed by various funding agencies to provide some outreach, but it's not going to be anytime soon at the level that, for example, I've experienced in the recent couple of years, how much time it's involved to communicate to the public, to the media, and to the newspapers.
Wieslaw Maslowski is a research professor at the Naval Postgraduate School. Other guests today at Climate One are Andy Gunther, Executive Director of the Center for Ecosystem Management and Restoration, and Will Travis, Executive Director of the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. I'm Greg Dalton. Andy Gunther, let's get your take on that, on the gap between science and public policy, and how to fill that knowledge gap or that communication gap between science and public policy.
It's a fundamentally important role, and I think there are shortages on both sides. That is, in the policy community, people want access to the most recent science, but they don't have the training or the time to go and extract it themselves. The scientific community, as Wieslaw is pointing out, often have absolutely no incentive other than their own, the goodness of their own heart and their desire to make a difference, to add on to all their other responsibilities the job of communicating. And so it does fall to people who can maybe have a foot in both places to do that communication. I think it's really important, too, to recognize a couple of things. First is, when you are trained as a scientist, you are trained to remove yourself from your work. So scientists tend to be really impressed by data way more than the public is impressed by data, and I have seen scientists communicate, and they'll put up some complex chart, and then they'll say, "See," and they don't understand the role that passion, relevance, and emotion play in communication. I feel doing an inadequate job of sitting in for Peter Ward. Peter's new book that's just coming out, called The Flooded Earth, starts with a description of Miami in 2100. And in fact, it's, Barnes & Noble will let you read it online to try and get you to buy the book. I would encourage you to read it. It's an interesting piece of scientific communication. There's no numbers in it. There is just taking the model predictions and then really applying it to what that means to the water system, the transportation system, the sewage system, and therefore the political implications of that. More and more now you're hearing our nation's military leaders speaking up. And in essence what they're doing is they are applying science using their expertise of threat assessment, and they are able to speak in ways that are much more accessible to people's thinking about the kinds of problems that will ensue, the political cascades of events that can be created by these ecological changes or these population changes. The amount of disinformation that's being sent to the public, of the amount of outright lying or the cherry picking of data where you just select one thing maybe from one place and then you claim that represents the globe, or you read one article and you start a blog and become an expert on why, all the world's climate scientists and the National Academy of Science is wrong and everything. That kind of thing is, I think, beginning to get the scientific community to become a little more aggressive in terms of speaking out.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell. Full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we look swell. Full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.